Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey, everyone. If you like this podcast, you should check out the full finance journey at realvision.com/RVpod to get the full view of what Real Vision is all about. A video on demand platform you can watch anywhere. Our members get daily videos and analysis, plus access to more than 3,000 videos for beginners and experienced investors alike, and live events online. You'll join the most thoughtful community in finance. More than 300,000 people who trust Real Vision to be the anchor to truth in the financial world. To get started, visit realvision.com/RVpod. Use the promo code podcast10 to get 10% off our essential membership for your first year. Enjoy the show.
Welcome to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. It's Wednesday, July 20, 2022. I'm Ash Bennington, joined today by Harry Melandri, strategist at Macro Intelligence 2 Partners. Welcome, Harry.
It's good to see you again, Ash. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Lots to talk about here. Before we get to it, let's take a look at equity markets. A lot of green on the screen today. Dow Jones Industrial Average up fractionally. S&P up 500, up about 0.6%, closing out very close to 4,000 at 3,959. But the big mover of the day is NASDAQ Composite, up one spot, 6% or thereabouts, closing out the day at 11,897. Once again, it's back to, a couple months ago with tech leading us higher. Harry, what's your take on what's happening in markets and more broadly in macro right now?
So all takes are inevitably a little subjective. And when I look at the world, I see mostly bad news. And my guess would be everybody else sees mostly the same bad news. And so I can't help but think of this move in markets as squeezy, as a short squeeze, as a counter move that's pushing people into their pain trade. I think a lot of players would have hedged, a lot of people will be underweight, and this is the most inconvenient move for them.
So what does the pain trade look like right now? How do you assess that, and where do you think we are in that cycle?
So I could go through and give you a list of bad things that are happening. My guess is that everybody knows every bad thing that's happening, except for COVID. I'm not sure everyone is aware of quite how bad the COVID situation is in various places and how much it's accelerating. And, you know, we don't really know whether COVID is still a significant health risk. We've got some ideas, but subjectively, we're told to no longer worry about it for various reasons. When I look at what's going on in hedge funds, I can see that hedge fund returns are way better. Recent historical returns are way better than the market's returns. Hmm. So overall, our friends in the hedge fund space have hedged their books, and they've hedged their books way better than retail has, generally speaking. I can't remember the exact number, but I'm thinking down 6% for the year in long short equity, which would be pretty heroic compared to what had been going on in that space prior. And I think macro guys as well have caught this, you know, a couple of ways. Well, the CTA guys have been absolutely nailing moves. CTAs have caught the down move in bonds, up move in rates really well. They caught the Dixie move, the move in the dollar index really well. And I think they're probably, it wouldn't surprise me if CTAs had chosen to reduce their positions, because if you think about the momentum in equity indices, it had been very solidly down. And then in the last couple of weeks, it's kind of been chopping around. So it wouldn't surprise me if to some degree CTAs are choosing to reduce their shorts at this point in time. Me personally, I just see bad news everywhere I look. But of course, it doesn't really matter what the old news is. It matters what the new news is. So perhaps the bad news is the old story and the new story is the Fed's going to change direction. I don't buy that personally, but that's just me.
So let's walk through those important points you just made there. First, on the COVID front, what do the data tell us? Obviously, we see a lot here in New York City. I've spent the last couple of days in bed. Just an hour or two before we went live here today, I got my COVID test back, my COVID PCR test back negative. It seems, unfortunately, to be on lots of folks' minds. What is the data telling you, and what's the significance as you think about the broader macro picture?
So I don't have the numbers to hand right now. I didn't really think to look these up. But here's what I've been reading about up till now. There are new Omicron-related strains. Those appear to be much more infectious and have, broadly speaking, to be less damaging per infection. So the greater degree of infectiousness means that we're actually seeing hospital beds increasingly occupied by it, even though the average person who contracts it probably won't get so sick. That, together with lack of mitigation, means that we've got quite a big wave going through us here and now. Now, does that matter? Well, to some degree, yeah, because some people are getting sick, because hospital capacity in places like the UK is impaired, partly because of so many sick NHS workers and partly because the temperature is ridiculously high in London right now. So altogether, there are places in the world you can look at and you can see, oh my God, there's a lot of COVID in that place. There's a lot of COVID in Turkey. There's a big wave going through Japan. China is interesting because, you know, they've got 700 cases over China as a whole. That's nothing compared to the rest of the world, but I thought they were meant to be zero COVID. So would we get another lockdown in China? And to what degree are our health systems going to be able to cope with this wave? Because the newer iterations of these Omicron-related strains appear to be, well, let's say the vaccines don't really do much and the previous immunity doesn't really do much. You can be reinfected. You can be reinfected, according to some people, within a month of a prior infection. So I don't know how important this is. We're about to find out.
Well, it's also interesting. Obviously, neither you nor I are immunologists, but let's talk a little bit about what you think about the potential risks to the animal spirits in the economy. How does that show up, if it does show up, and how will we know?
Well, my animal spirits are being crushed. I don't know about yours. I get given my boss, Julian Brigden, gives me research projects. He says, go and look at this. He's got great instincts. And he often, it's surprising how often, where he tells me to go and have a look, I'm shocked by what I see after I go and have a look. So his research project recently has been the real estate market. And I think anyone who's observing what's going on in US real estate knows that it stopped stone cold dead January / February between those. And a lot of that is, you know, it's this very simple thing. If you add 250 basis points to 30-year fixed rates, you can expect anybody who needs to borrow 30-year fixed to buy a place is going to find themselves priced out. It's not going to work anymore. So that's one side of that. And that's not so surprising, right? The Fed jacked up rates. It hit the long end just as much as the short end. And those purchases of real estate stopped. From what I'm hearing from Julian, he's surprised at the extent of leverage and the extent of speculation that was happening kind of under the radar. So you have places like Boise, Idaho, where there's a, you know, significant amount of land purchased and development, spec development going on, where the pricing for that doesn't make any sense anymore. The people who are selling out of California to go to Boise are now worried they may have to go back to California to work at their jobs. That remote distancing maybe reducing, and the kind of, we're talking about 75% annual price appreciation in these markets. It looks like we'll give back an awful lot of that. So that's on the real estate front. He asked me to look at private equity. When I look at private equity, the same thing happened there. Private equity financial conditions tightened really sharply at the start of the year. Valuations in recently IPO'd stocks have absolutely cratered. You can look up Uber and you can look up DoorDash. You don't need me to tell you. But the same is true for the unlisted holdings. And the reason it's not so clear is because nobody shifts a valuation until they do a new fundraising round. So the most transparent fundraising we had was from Klarna. Klarna is a kind of buy now, pay later fintech, if you will. They front money to people. And you split it into four equal tranches, your payment into those tranches, and you pay the same. So basically, they must have negotiated a discount somewhere down the line. Klarna did a fundraising round last year where I think they were valued at $46 billion. They've just done another one in June where they were valued at, I think, $6.5 billion. And if you think about how much private equity there is in the world, well, it's been growing steadily for near enough 20 years. It's everywhere, endowments, pensions. And the more I dug, the more it seemed to me that it crept into everything. You know, do you remember the Jeremy Stein comment from like 2013?
This
explains why no one invites me to parties, right? But back in
you're always invited to this party,
man. Back in 2013, Jeremy Stein, who was a Fed governor, gave a speech where he said, you know, monetary policy is a pretty blunt tool, but it does have the virtue that it gets in all the cracks. And he meant that if you leave monetary policy too accommodative, if you tighten it enough, you will deal with hidden spec in the system that the Fed maybe doesn't see or can't regulate. But you can reverse that. If you don't tighten, if you have very accommodative monetary policy for an extended period of time, then why wouldn't there be the development of expansion in areas that are not regulated by regulators, that are not controlled by the Fed and are not so visible to them, private equity?
It's an interesting comment because I guess you could say it in a more cynical way, which is the downside of monetary policy is that it absolutely nukes everything. And so, you know, it is this kind of double-edged sword. But talking about the price pressure that seeps in across the board, I wanted to touch on something today, obviously a very big story. UK inflation now at a 40-year high, CPI coming in, this is Consumer Price Index, coming in at 9.4%. year over year. That's above consensus. Indeed, coming in at the highest level since 1982. That's the Iron Lady era. This is the Thatcher regime. This is a very long time. It's a very ugly print.
Yeah. And, you know, me personally, I don't think it's the last of them. These things are often auto-correlated. One high print tends to follow another high print tends to follow another. And you know, the phrase second round effects, it's not so popular over here, but among European central bankers, there was somebody somewhere was always uttering the phrase second round effects for the last 20 years out of the ECB. What do they mean by second round effect? They mean that higher inflation tends to result in higher wages. People will go on strike and demand higher wages. And the way I think about this is, the higher inflation has already resulted in everyone paying higher taxes. You drift into a higher tax bracket, you get that fiscal drag effect. So one way or another, you're probably paying higher taxes because of higher inflation to the extent that your wages have kept up at all. But you could we're getting into that phase now where you're seeing trade unions in the UK saying, hey, I've just had a 10% real wage decrease. I'd like some of that back. I'm not putting up with that. My living standard has declined by 10% minimum. And truth is, it's probably more than that, right? The inflation statistics are probably underestimating the extent to which living standards in the UK and in the US and globally have declined because of higher energy prices and higher general inflation. So we're getting into that point where we're going to find out the degree to which labor can push back against that real wage decline. And my suspicion is it's going to be a pretty bloody fight, right? Nobody wants to get poorer.
We're going to take a quick break and be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan. But nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
You know, talking about bloody fights here, the dilemma that central banks find themselves in, the Scylla and Charybdis, I want you to talk about the other side of this equation here, which is the bottom falling out of Eurozone consumer confidence, down to a minus 27% print. This is the lowest level ever on record. How do central banks begin to think about how they split the difference, evaluate this when they've got challenges on both sides of the dual mandate, at least here in the U.S., where there is a dual mandate?
So I think it's a boiling frogs metaphor. What you want to do is to persuade people that the inflation is temporary. You want to reduce the attempted the effort to repudiate the declining living standards. Workers are going to push for higher pay rises. You have to tell them it's temporary. It may not be as temporary as you tell them. And the same is true for companies, right? There's upward movements on profitability at the moment. Then that will switch to downward movements on profitability. There will be attempts to claw that back by pushing those price increases onto consumers. I'm personally surprised by the resilience of consumer confidence. Have you seen the heating price rises they're talking about in the UK? And obviously we're aware that there are things going on with respect to the Russia-Ukraine war and gas supply in Europe, which may result in significantly higher heating prices across the entire continent. None of this is good.
So let's talk about it, particularly for an American audience who may see those headlines but not really understand the significance of nat gas, the geopolitics behind it, and the implications for the economy in Europe and also the animal spirits. I mean, you're reading these articles, some on the right, some on the left, that suggest that we're looking at a potential to see people dying this winter because of inadequate fuel supplies or because of rises in prices. These are truly horrifying sort of commentary at the human level as well as at the economic level.
So I know I'm going to come across terrible when I say this, but actually people die every winter because of an insufficient heating. The question is how many, and yeah, there'll be more. There'll be a lot more. And this problem, I mean, I look at this and I think to myself, what we've got is a perfect storm for industrial relations all over Europe. You're seeing political pressure expressed. You're seeing bigger and bigger demonstrations. The ones in Italy, I don't know if you saw the ones they had demonstrating against Mario Draghi. I don't know how good your Italian swearing is. I think your Italian swearing is pretty good. But even I recognized what they were saying, and it wasn't very sweet of them. What shocked me was when I was looking at that coverage, I saw a lady complaining that she could not buy bread in Rome. So when you get that kind of complaint, that kind of pressure, the political pressure becomes impossible to resist. So me personally, I think these second round effects are going to be meaningful, that we probably haven't got inflation under control. And we haven't got it under control because we don't have the politics under control.
Sobering comments, Harry.
I didn't mean it to be. I think a lot of people get it, and a lot of people are disconcerted by what they're seeing. That doesn't mean stocks have to go down, because I think people have understood how bad things are and have positioned accordingly. So actually, temporarily, if we don't get a continual flow of bad news, I don't see why things can't bounce. But the thing that I never get out of my head is I don't really understand why the Russian supply of natural gas to Europe is not further restricted. Why would they allow European gas storage to refill before the winter? If they do that, their leverage over NATO and over Europe is much reduced. So I don't get why that would actually happen. I don't know why people would assume that outcome is the most likely outcome.
By the way, for people following this, there was a fascinating chart in the Wall Street Journal yesterday that showed the curves of the capacity of fill in natural gas storage across Europe. And essentially, it's just a curve. It looks the same every year. They call summer the filling season. So what you can see is how these supplies are building up, how the inventory is building up or not building up, as the case may be, across these months as we head into the winter season. It's an interesting story, and it's something that there are data points around.
Absolutely. You know, if you're looking for data porn, you should take a look at baseload electricity prices in France or Germany. They are absolutely terrifying. Both 1 year forward and spot, 1 day forward in France hit a new record, I think, yesterday. And that's
as a percentage of spot or an absolute
term? No, 1 day forward in absolute terms. Basically, there's a deficit of electricity supply in France because they have commitments. They're a big exporter of electricity. And there's a shortage of nuclear at the moment in France for various reasons. So the high temperatures combined with the lack of gas have pushed up demand for electricity relative to supply, and there's a problem. And that price increase, it's a factor of 10. From memory, it's a factor of about 10 higher than it was last year. Can you imagine a 10 times higher electricity bill? How does any industry operate under those conditions? So, I mean, that might just be a function of the weather at the moment in Europe, but there's a chronic energy supply problem. Now, me personally, I'm way too invested in things like Argentinian restructured debt. Why do I mention that now? Argentina imports LNG, right? And there are hundreds is an exaggeration, but there's a lot of countries, particularly in the third world, that are dependent on LNG for their energy supply. Pakistan, Argentina, almost every country in Asia, frankly, imports large quantities of LNG. Well, you know, it hasn't helped that Europe is now a huge LNG importer. And you've seen price increases of an order of factor of 10 in LNG prices globally. Argentina's bidding $40 to $50 as it's tendering for LNG contracts for five or six loads or something. And they're paying 10 times more than they were a year ago. No wonder they have fiscal problems.
Well, this is obviously an important story, a serious story. It would be great to have you back to do more of a deep dive. Perhaps you jump on, Harry, and interview someone about this.
You know, this is not my specialist subject. God knows what is my specialist. But, you know, I had a podcast.
This is why you make a great interviewer on this topic. Let's get someone in to scratch that itch for curiosity, because I think it really is an important story. But I wanted to shift gears here back to something we were talking about a little bit earlier, which is this challenge, this balancing act that global central banks are attempting to perform. I say this because there's a really interesting clip that I wanted to take a look at. This is a conversation between Harris Kupperman and Stephen Clapham from today called "Is This the Golden Age of Event-Driven Strategies?" This is available on Essential Plus and Pro for Real Vision subscribers, airing on 7/14, actually. Let's take a look at this clip.
In terms of the Federal Reserve, I think they're going to slow down. I don't think they're going to cut. I don't see that. But I think they're going to take a pause. What they've done, it's one of the fastest rate of changes really in Fed history in terms of interest rates. In terms of what they've done with reverse repos, which is really just, you know, QT under a different name, in terms of, not just what the Fed funds have done, but the whole curve has done in pricing out. I mean, the Federal Reserve, they have three tools. They have QE, QT, they have interest rates, and they have the wealth effect. And the wealth effect is the largest drawdown in the history of the wealth effect. And so all three of these, work with a lag. And the Federal Reserve historically, they basically respond to mob rule. Congress gets mad, fix inflation. So they push too hard and they break something. Oh, the economy's crashing, do something. They print too much and they create asset bubbles. They need to slow down, deep breath, methodical. These things take 6 months or a year to make it through the system. And I think they've done a lot so far, and they're starting to break stuff. We're seeing it in the funding market. We're seeing it in ABS market and MBS and CMBS. You're starting to see it in asset prices. They were chasing oil higher effectively. Everything else is kind of ephemeral, but the price of oil has backed off in the last couple of weeks, so they finally have some cover to slow down. Industrial metals have collapsed. You know, I don't know what food is doing, but labor is going to slow down because all the guys trading meme stocks are showing up to work again. I think, you know, the inflationary numbers, plus you have base effects. And so you're coming up right now against peak STEMI. And as we get into the fall, you're not against peak STEMI anymore. And it'll give them cover to pause and take a breath and reevaluate. And they don't want to be hiking into an election. I mean, that's not how the Fed ever does anything.
Well, that's Cuppy adverting to precisely what we were just talking about, this balance of risk faced by global central banks. In this case, the Fed saying essentially that he doesn't think they're going to cut, but they may be slowing down the rate of increase. Thoughts about that, Harry, and how that decision gets made?
I don't have any direct contact with the Fed. There was a point when I did, but I do have friends and colleagues who are much closer to Fed officials and do have contact with them. And my understanding from talking to those guys is that Fed officials are dismayed by the current level of inflation. I mean, nobody, if I were Jay Powell, I wouldn't want to go down in history as the next Arthur Burns. And the rumors we've heard is that Jay Powell has actually printed off the minutes of the key decision in, I think, 1974, when the Fed chose to loosen in the face of higher inflation rather than tighten because of fiscal issues. So everybody knows what they're trying to avoid at the Fed. But, you know, you can try and avoid something. And people in the past weren't stupid. They had those problems for a reason. I can definitely see the serious and widespread wealth destruction that I think Mr. Cuppy was talking about. Yeah. I've come across back of the envelope calculations suggesting $20 trillion or more of wealth destruction. A lot of it in govy bonds globally because of duration effects. 30% drawdown in stocks doesn't help. I know that there's $10 trillion worth of private equity that's been marked down, God knows how much. And then we have crypto, where this God knows how many trillion dollars got messed up there. So it's hard for me to conceive that you can take $20 trillion and nuke it, and it doesn't have any collateral effects on the real economy, on wealth effects, on consumption. So, yeah, we all, I think my understanding is the Fed believes that we will see the inflationary pressures moderate by the autumn. And this is where I have a problem, right? Because I'm not sure that's right. If some proportion, 30 to 40% of the US CPI is driven by shelter components. The shelter components haven't stopped going up. I mean, rent's going up even if pricing is going down. People all want to buy, all want to rent. Nobody wants to buy right now. So there's significant shelter inflation. There's additional inflation in, bear in mind that OE, owner equivalent rent, is a constructed series. When that starts to go up like it did in the previous month, it tends to continue. So for all of these reasons, my suspicion is that the Fed might well be disappointed with the inflation performance come the autumn. And autumn seems to me to be a horrible kind of confluence of events where we find out how bad COVID is at the same time as we find out how bad the gas supply situation is in Europe, at the same time as we get statements from our private equity funds, or the trustees of pension funds get their statements through. So we may find that autumn we get a whole bunch of negative effect coming through, and that while the Fed is getting some enormously high and surprisingly high prints in inflation, even if the underlying inflationary picture sometime in the future is coming down, the next 3 to 4 months are not going to be pretty. The comparisons with last year are too difficult. So
Harry, you're beginning to depress me here, man.
You know, my wife says that all the time. But look, we live through challenging times. That doesn't mean we can't be happy. But I'm not sure how bullish I am of stocks, even with a big short, even with people out there who have anticipated the negative setup and are trading for it. I think we squeeze, but I find it hard to believe the situation won't deteriorate further as we approach the autumn.
We're going to take another quick break and be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why? And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
So a couple of points here that I wanted to touch on. Since you mentioned crypto, we should say Bitcoin trading above the 23,000 level and Ethereum up over 1,500, perhaps on word of a date certain being set to, or at least a range coming up for the merge ahead. Second thing I wanted to mention was that chart from the Wall Street Journal yesterday. If we can take a look at that, I think our crack producing team got it to get this up on the fly here. So what you can see from this chart is the very regularity of that curve. You can see it stacked year over year there. I don't think 2022 is on that chart, but you can get the general gist of what's being talked about here. And as you were saying, the richness of these data sets so that you can get very precise idea on where we are and how much the risk is that we see unfolding. So an interesting data series and one we're going to keep an eye on. And I suspect to have more conversations about here on Real Vision in the short and intermediate term. Harry, I wanted to jump in and switch gears here because we've got a lot of questions coming in. What do you say? Get a couple minutes to do like a quick speed round, see how we can get through a couple of these.
Sure, I'd love to.
Great. So the first question comes from John A. This is from the Real Vision site. And the question is, outlook for 10-year treasury, specifically given QT might actually start someday. So translation here, John is asking about the 10-year treasury yield and price. And he's saying specifically, hey, you know, we might actually start reducing this balance sheet at some point.
So I keep on trying to buy fixed income and I'm not, it hasn't been rewarding as an experience. And part of the problem there are the inflation numbers. Every time an inflation number comes out and I'm carrying a long fixed income position, I get nervous because I know that any single inflation number could show another outsized high print. There's no reason why that won't happen. You know, if anything, the terms of trade shift towards energy producers and towards food producers and away from service producing economies is enormously profound. So on the one hand, I keep thinking that these rates are too high to be sustained. And on the other hand, it's not working out for me so good at the moment. So what can I say?
Well, you're in good company. It's this aspect of the notion that the 60-40 portfolio is breaking down, the historical correlation is breaking down. We're seeing, obviously, today's a bit of reversal of the trend on both fronts. But, you know, the broader point remains intact. This has been very challenging for people who run money, portfolio managers, for people who are trying to get a sense of where this is going.
Yeah, it's inflation is higher than the Fed can control. And we're being led to believe the Fed will get it under control. But when?
Yeah. Here's a question that comes to us from Tim, New York, from the Real Vision website. Harry, why is there so much talk about how negative things are now? This is a walk in the park compared to 2008. What am I missing? Or has the worst not come yet? Your thoughts? Great question.
So in housing, and excuse me for that. Let me see if I can get rid of that. So in housing, this is apparent. You would think that it's nowhere near as bad as 2008. And that was definitely my diagnosis until Julian had done some recent work. But it depends which market you're looking at. And in certain markets, it's an incredibly difficult, the supply-demand balance is much worse than you would expect. I'm talking about places which have seen enormous price appreciation. So we're talking about Florida, perhaps. We're talking about Boise, Idaho. We're talking about Austin. Austin has been fantastic. If you were long of Austin 3 years ago, God knows how much money you've made on that. Why be surprised if that comes down a bit? And the spec for certain housing developments in these markets, I hadn't thought there was much spec in it. I'd thought lending standards were pretty tight. But in practice, the more we dig, the more we see hidden leverage in those markets. So first of all, untidy answer, but the right way of putting it is, the place where the excess, the malinvestment was last time around in 2008 was definitely housing. This time around, the malinvestment in housing is probably significantly smaller, but maybe you should be looking in private equity. And maybe you're lucky enough not to have private equity, so the malinvestment is significantly smaller for you. The losses, you're not looking at 60% write-downs on your private equity. If you had private equity, you might well be looking at that 60% write-down and saying, oh my God, this is so much worse than it was in 2008. And one other observation, like anecdote-wise, I got a colleague of mine, Stephen. He's very good at picking up some cute anecdotes. He's noticed that light airplanes and small boats are getting surprisingly cheap. You can pick up a light airplane now for $75,000. That's incredibly unusual. The kind of people who might have that, maybe we time them high net worth individuals. High net worth individuals, doctors, dentists, lawyers. Suddenly, if for some reason, have decided now is the time to sell their light airplane. Interesting, no?
Very interesting. By the way, pardon my chuckling, but I'm looking at the streaming comments here on YouTube. This one coming in from Wade Cleveland. The modern 60-40 portfolio has 60% options and 40% meme stocks.
You know, that's going to give you an awful lot of theta on that portfolio. Your decay could be uncomfortable. I've got an awful lot of S&P puts. I'm not enjoying the experience here and now.
Wait, what about options on meme stocks?
You know, they'll be expensive too. I prefer to write them than own them, but I think it may be the covered call moment has passed for the time being.
If you're doing it naked, you've got bigger nerve than I do.
Swimming naked, what's this anecdote about when the tide comes back out after you've gone swimming naked? So we're in that kind of environment right now.
Harry, we got about 60 seconds left. Final thoughts, key takeaways that you'd like to leave our audience with?
So these markets are very thin. Volumes are lighter than usual, and they're going to get thinner into August. Do not be surprised by where we could trade up a significant way. We could trade down a significant way. There's not an awful lot of liquidity there, not much to stop outsized price movements. So you should scale your trades appropriately. And then secondly, you know, I don't know how bearish you are. I'm pretty bearish. I can see an awful lot of things to be concerned about. That doesn't prove in any way that markets will go down. I don't know to what extent people have discounted, roughly speaking, the same thing I'm looking at, but it's hard for me to believe that gas storage in Europe will ever get back to the 90% level that it usually gets to in November. And I think that will lead to significant problems down the line, and something, you know, 5 to 6% of German GDP minimum has to get shut down.
Well, Harry, I'm aggressively neutral as always, but I feel like I may need a group therapy session.
But look at the beautiful weather. There's so much hot, sunny weather all around the world.
It's like 97 degrees. It's like 97 degrees and 160% humidity right now in New York City.
I see your glass is half empty at this point.
After this conversation, absolutely. I just want to add ice to that glass. Harry Melagri, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. I'm so sorry to doom so much on people. I didn't mean to. I just want people to kind of think about the issues.
Well said. And thanks again for watching the Real Vision Daily Briefing. Tomorrow, Maggie Lake will be back with David Wu. Thanks for watching, everybody.
What's up, revolutionaries? Thanks for tuning in to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. For more content like this, head over to realvision.com and get unfiltered access to the very best, brightest, and biggest names in finance.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at caskers.com.